Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will bring you stories along with Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, the 12 boys and their soccer coach rescued from a flooded cave in northern Thailand appeared in public for the first time on Wednesday. The boys are ages 11 to 16. They waved, smiled, and offered the traditional Thai greeting Y on a national television broadcast. They wore shirts with an image of a wild boar. That is what the soccer team is called. They kicked footballs around the television set, which had goalposts and nets like a soccer field. A large sign had the words, "Bringing the wild boars home." One of the boys, Adu Samon, described the moment when two British cave divers found the group on July 2nd. "It was magical," he said. "I had to think a lot before I could answer their questions." The discovery launched the rescue effort that brought them all to safety over 3 days. Members of the Thai Navy SEALs and an international team of cave diving experts organized the rescue effort. Coach Ekapon Chantawang has been credited with keeping the boys alive. He said the order in which the boys were rescued did not depend on the state of their health. He said, "The ones whose homes are the furthest went first, so they could tell everyone that the boys were fine." The group had planned to explore the Tam Luang Cave Complex after soccer practice on June 23rd, but rainwater flooded the tunnels, trapping them inside. "We took turns digging at the cave walls," Ekapon said. "We didn't want to wait around until authorities found us." One of the boys added, "We used stones to dig in the cave. We dug 3 to 4 meters. The group had no food on a trip which they thought would only last an hour in the cave. For nearly 10 days, they survived on water dripping from stalactites in the cave. One of the boys, T, said, "We only drank water." Titan, the team's youngest member, said, "I had no strength. I tried not to think about food, so I didn't get more hungry." One boy was worried about his parents. He said, "I was afraid that I wouldn't go home and I would get scolded by my mother." Two of the boys held up a drawing of Saman Kunan. He was the former Thai Navy diver who died while preparing for their rescue. "Everyone was very sad," said the coach Ekapon. He added that the boys would spend time as Buddhist religious workers to honor the diver's memory. They felt like they were the reason he had to die and his family had to suffer.
A U.S. federal judge has ordered the Trump administration to stop immediate deportations of immigrant families. The order, which is enforced until at least July 24th, would give families time to decide their next steps. U.S. District Judge Dana Sabra of San Diego issued the order Monday after a court filing from the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU. The filing raised concerns that the government would try to immediately deport families when they were reunited. The ACLU argued that the families must have time to understand their legal rights and decide whether to apply for asylum. Sabra asked the government to respond before the next hearing on July 24th. Until then, Sabra stopped immediate deportations. The Trump administration's policy of separating families led to condemnation around the world. On June 20th, Trump ended the policy as the court had ordered the government to reunite more than 2,500 children with their families by July 26th. Jorge Barón is executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. He said the ban on immediate deportations buys us a little bit of time. He said he was still unsure of whether contact has been made with all parents detained in his part of the country. Barón's group has secured lawyers for many separated families in detention centers in the state of Washington. But even on Monday, he said, he learned of an immigrant mother who had not made contact with a lawyer. He believes that she might have gone ignored without the judge's order. Many of the immigrants are fleeing violence in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras.
The United States has settled a case with a guns rights activist that permits him to publish instructions for making guns with a 3D printer. Activist Cody Wilson began legal action against the government in 2015 after it forced him to remove files he had placed on the internet. The files provided directions for making a handgun with a 3D printer. Wilson had made such a gun himself and had successfully test-fired it in 2013. He named the gun the Liberator. Tens of thousands of people downloaded plans to make their own gun. Wilson has called such weapons downloadable guns. But the U.S. State Department said Wilson's files broke laws on international gun trafficking. Wilson and his legal team argued in court that the State Department order violated Wilson's right to free speech. They noted that the files shared on the internet contained only plans, not weapons or gun parts. Wilson teamed up in the case with an organization called the Second Amendment Foundation. The Second Amendment guarantees Americans the right to keep and bear arms. The foundation recently announced it had reached a settlement with the U.S. government. It said the agreement, offered by the U.S. Justice Department, permits Wilson to legally put his instructional materials back on the Internet. The Justice Department did not publicly comment on the settlement. The agreement was confirmed in court documents provided to several major media organizations. The Second Amendment Foundation's founder and executive vice president, Alan M. Gottlieb, praised the settlement. Gottlieb called the decision a victory for free speech. He added that he believed the settlement represented a major defeat for groups seeking to increase government gun controls. A message on Wilson's Defense Distributed website announced he plans to relaunch the website DefCAD on August 1st. This will permit him to freely share instructions for making 3D printed guns. The age of the downloadable gun formally begins, the message reads. I consider it a truly grand thing, Wilson told Wired magazine about the decision. It will be an irrevocable part of political life that guns are downloadable, and we helped to do that. The DefCAD website currently lists information on a number of other 3D printed weapons, in addition to the first gun introduced in 2013. These include the semi-automatic models AR-10 and AR-15, as well as a Beretta M9 handgun and others. Gun control supporters are expected to oppose the settlement. They have argued against 3D guns because they can be made without the usual government registration requirements. These guns also do not have manufacturing numbers for identification purposes. Since there is no record or history for guns created this way, they have also been called ghost weapons. Wired magazine has named Wilson on several of its yearly lists of the most dangerous people on the Internet. Wilson told the magazine the new website will accept instructional materials from users as well. His goal is to provide a searchable, user-created collection of information on how to make any firearm. Wilson's organization also sells some weapons that are 80% complete. He explains in a website video that because they are 20% unfinished, he is permitted to sell them as pieces of metal instead of guns. Buyers of the unfinished firearms can then use their own equipment to complete the weapon. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue our series of time capsule programs, each one exploring another facet, decade, or period of America in the 20th century. Science brings an end to World War II and lays the groundwork for a new attention to research, development, and scientific education in the years to come. World War II ended with an action that was never taken before in the history of warfare and has never been taken since. It required the efforts of a team of scientists. Working in secrecy, they designed and built the first atomic bombs. President Harry S. Truman made the decision to use these weapons against Japan in August of 1945.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
America's use of atomic weapons brought years of conflict in Europe and the Pacific to an end. But it also marked the beginning of the nuclear age. And it represented, in a dramatic way, the growing importance of science and technology in modern times. Interest in science goes back to the earliest days of the nation. President Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin were famous not only as political leaders, but also as inventors and scientists. President Abraham Lincoln and Congress established the National Academy of Sciences during the Civil War in the 1860s. And in the early 1900s, the nation created scientific offices to study and improve agriculture, public health, even air travel. By the start of World War I in 1914, the federal government was employing scientists in many areas of work. President Woodrow Wilson created the National Research Council to organize the work of scientists and engineers to win the war. However, before World War II, government support for science was generally limited. The government was willing to pay for research only to meet certain clear goals, such as better weapons or military transport systems. World War II greatly changed the traditionally limited relationship between American scientists and the federal government. In the early years of the war, the German forces of Adolf Hitler showed the world the power of their new tanks, guns, and other weapons. President Franklin Roosevelt knew that the United States would need to develop modern weapons of its own if it entered the war. For this reason, Roosevelt established a National Defense Research Committee in 1940 to support and organize research on weapons. The new committee included some of the top scientists in America. Among its members were the presidents of Harvard University, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Bell Laboratories. The committee did its work so well that Roosevelt later formed an even more powerful Office of Scientific Research and Development. The leader of both groups was Vannevar Bush, no relation to the future presidents. He had long experience as a professor of electrical engineering and as an inventor. Many scientists knew him. Vannevar Bush put together a hard-working team, and in the years that followed, American scientists and engineers developed one invention after another to help the war effort. scientists developed new devices to help the Navy find German submarines. They improved methods for bombers to find their targets, and they developed more powerful rockets to protect American troops when they landed on foreign beaches. American scientists and doctors also made great progress in improving the methods of wartime medicine. World War II may well have been the first war in history in which a wounded soldier was more likely to survive than to die. But in many ways, the most important scientific development of the period was the atomic bomb. In 1939, Albert Einstein wrote President Roosevelt a letter. The scientist told the president that it might soon be possible to build a powerful weapon, a weapon that would use the power of the atom. And he urged Roosevelt to get American scientists to build the atomic bomb before German scientists could build one. Roosevelt agreed. He created a special team of scientists. Their work became known as the Manhattan Project. Roosevelt made sure that these scientists got all the money and supplies they needed. Roosevelt died before the scientists could complete their work. But in April 1945, the scientists told the new president, Harry Truman, that they were almost ready to test their invention. Just 3 months later, they exploded the world's first atomic bomb in the desert in the southwestern state of New Mexico. Truman had to make a difficult decision. He knew the atomic bomb would cause widespread death and suffering if it was used on a Japanese city. But he was willing to do anything to avoid the need for American troops to invade Japan. In Japan, a new prime minister and government were searching for a way to end the war. But Truman believed that the Japanese were still not ready to surrender, and he felt it was his duty to end the war as soon as possible. On August 6, 1945, the first atomic bomb fell on the city of Hiroshima. 3 days later, a second A-bomb fell on the city of Nagasaki.
Having found the atomic bomb, we have used it. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war. Only a Japanese surrender will stop us.
President Truman.
It is an awful responsibility which has come to us. We thank God that it has come to us instead of to our enemies.
The Radiation Effects Research Foundation in Japan estimates that between 150,000 and 246,000 people died within 2 to 4 months of the bombings. The bombings left Japan's rulers with no choice. In less than 1 week, they surrendered.
I received this afternoon a message from the Japanese government. I deem this reply a full acceptance of the Potsdam Declaration, which specifies the unconditional surrender of Japan. In the reply, there is no qualification. Arrangements are now being made for the formal signing of the surrender terms at the earliest possible moment. General Douglas MacArthur has been appointed the Supreme Allied Commander to receive the Japanese surrender.
In this newsreel, we hear General MacArthur accepting the surrender of the Japanese Empire.
The battleship Missouri, 53,000-ton flagship of Admiral Halsey's Third Fleet, becomes the scene of an unforgettable ceremony marking the complete and formal surrender of Japan. General of the Army Douglas MacArthur, Supreme Allied Commander for the occupation of Japan, boards the Missouri. Fleet Admiral Nimitz, Pacific Fleet Commander, and Admiral Halsey welcome MacArthur and his Chief of Staff, General Sutherland, aboard. It is Sunday, September 2nd, 1945.
We are gathered here, representatives of the major warring powers, to conclude a solemn agreement whereby peace may be restored. The issues involving divergent ideals and ideologies have been determined on the battlefields of the world, and hence are not for our discussion or debate. The terms and conditions upon which surrender of the Japanese Imperial Forces is here to be given and accepted are contained in the instrument of surrender now before you. I now invite the representatives of the Emperor of Japan and the Japanese government and the Japanese Imperial General Headquarters to sign the instrument of surrender at the places indicated.
American scientists and engineers proved that a war could be won with research as well as bullets. And all Americans learned how much could be gained when government agencies, scientists, and universities worked together for common goals. Roosevelt had understood this long before the war ended. He asked Vannevar Bush to study how the federal government could work with scientists and universities in peacetime. Bush offered a number of ideas to President Truman at the end of the war. He told the president that science was important to America's progress and safety. He called on the federal government to support scientific study and education. Professor Bush said that the nation's universities should be greatly strengthened. He called for the creation of a new government agency to provide money for science projects. Truman and Congress agreed with Vannevar Bush, and in the next few years, American research efforts expanded. In 1946, the Office of Naval Research was created to support basic science study in universities. In the same year, the government created the Atomic Energy Commission. And in 1950, it created the National Science Foundation to provide support to thousands of the nation's best scientists. In the years that followed, American science would grow beyond the wildest dreams of Vannevar Bush and other scientists of his time. Universities would add thousands of new students, along with new laboratories and research centers. By the middle of the 1960s, the federal government would spend more than $13 billion a year for research and development. And 500 new centers of higher learning would be created. All this investment would help make the United States the world leader in such fields as computer science, genetics, and space travel.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.